Our next speaker this morning is Ross Fisher. Ross has made his career in public service. He's currently the attorney for the city of Seguin, as well as the municipal judge for the city of Wood Creek. He's currently serving as the chairman of the Texas Ethics Commission, which is responsible for enforcing ethic laws and the political process. From 2001 to 2004, Mr. Fisher was the Kendall County attorney, and he currently resides in Kendalia with his wife and two daughters. Please welcome Ross Fisher.
All right. Thank you, Judge. Everybody hear me all right? Julian, you hear me back there? All right. Let's see a show of hands, everybody that's jazzed about foreign nationals and immigration issues. All right, let's start by asking this. We have any immigration law practitioners in here today? All right, we've got an expert witness, perfect. Somebody to keep me honest. Any immigration experts here? Just you. All right, tell me your name and where you're from. Okay, good. I'm going to you with any hard questions because I'm not an immigration lawyer. I'm not an immigration law expert. I don't pretend to be. And maybe that's why they chose me to teach the basics of immigration and foreign national law, because my knowledge is basic. So don't get your hopes up. But I think that we can cover some basics and hopefully raise some issues that you as municipal judges need to be aware of. The one little gap in my intro that Gary read, I was a county attorney for 4 years, and I've been a city attorney for a while, but I spent 2 years in between as a prosecutor for the State Bar of Texas, prosecuting some of my colleagues throughout the state, and actually out in this area, in Odessa and Midland. I was joking with somebody, I've eaten more meals at the Chili's at Love Field than I care to think about, waiting to catch the next flight out to Midland. So it's good to be back out here, but I prosecuted lawyers. I learned enough about it. It was interesting because I had to prosecute for all manner of violations, and I had to learn enough about different areas of the law to make a judgment call and make a case. And immigration law is probably the most difficult and specialized that I ever had to wrap my brain around. It's not something that you dabble in, okay? It's very specialized, it's very complicated, and so I had to learn a little bit about that because I prosecuted some of my fellow lawyers for immigration, for mishandling immigration cases, which I think is an easy thing to do. Let me ask you, how many unscrupulous lawyers do we have here today? Nobody willing to, okay. Immigration law is a great area if you're an unscrupulous lawyer, okay, because what you can do is take someone's money, neglect their case, and by the time they're ready to file a complaint against you, they're in another country. So when your complaining witness has been deported, hey, that's great if you're an unscrupulous lawyer. So there's some free advice. You may want to consider immigration law. All right, so I'm the judge in Wood Creek. I don't magistrate because we don't have a jail. We don't even have a police department. I don't encounter foreign nationals very often in my role as judge as Wood Creek. There are rumors in Wood Creek that one of the residents may be from Canada. That's unconfirmed. I don't know if that's true or not. But we're still good for all municipal judges to know, because sooner or later you're going to have someone in your court. How many of you act as magistrates? Okay, good. You're going to encounter somebody, and even those of you that don't have magistrate duties, you're going to encounter someone that you suspect is a foreign national. And so if this be a little primer for how to help you address those situations. All right, we have a very basic objectives today. We're going to talk about some examples of local, I don't call them immigration ordinances. I'm not sure if there is such a thing as immigration ordinances legally. We're going to talk about some local immigration-related issues or initiatives on the local level that attempt to deal with immigration, rightfully or wrongfully. We're going to talk about the Vienna Convention on Consular Notifications, which will be an issue for those of you that magistrate, and we're going to talk a little bit about ICE holds. Okay. Now, let's talk about, I've told you this is going to be very basic, let's talk about what it's not. I'm not, I'm not Lou Dobbs. I'm not Sean Hannity. I'm not a talk show host. I'm not interested in engaging in political debate. No offense. So if we can just agree this is an academic exercise and not a political discussion, I think we'll get through this a lot better. Can we all agree to that? Anyone who's hell-bent on having a political debate? Okay, good. Thank you. I encourage questions and discourage opinions. And I'm going to direct all the questions to our expert right here, so I'll tell you that right now. So this is what we're going to talk about, are these three things. And hopefully you'll leave here with a slightly better understanding of some of these issues in the event that you encounter them. All right, here we go. This was a quote that I found in preparing this that I thought was interesting, to say the least. This is from the mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania. We're going to talk about Hazleton in a little bit. They are one of the most aggressive cities in the United States in trying to handle immigration issues at a local level. And their mayor said, this is his quote, "Thousands of cities in America are crying out for relief from the burden of illegal immigration. Small towns like mine can no longer wait for Washington." So I think this is something that we've seen over the last couple of years, is this sort of attitude manifesting itself. Whether you agree with that, subscribe to it or not, it is an issue that's gotten more and more attention. Along those same lines is the sheriff from Bradley County, Tennessee, who said the federal government is not doing their job of securing our borders, and that's clear. By them not doing their job, it's making it hard on us being local law enforcement officials. So we're going to talk a little bit about these local immigration initiatives and maybe what you can do or what you can't do if you're to encounter these in your city. How many of you are from a city that has tried to do something immigration related through a local ordinance? Anybody? Alvin? Okay. I had the farmer's branch judge in the last time that I spoke, and he kind of sheepishly raised his hands. Okay, so let's talk about these local immigration initiatives. I have this in quote, immigration ordinances, because I don't know that there is such a thing. This is Prince William County, Virginia. They adopted a measure that required public library and parks, okay, libraries and parks, to verify citizenship before providing services. And they directed the police to determine the status of anyone thought to be violating a local ordinance. Now, I'm a city attorney, and we have a lot of local ordinances, and I think about our police department, and I think about all the ordinances, and I think about the two trying to, telling our police department, you need to determine the citizenship of anyone violating a local ordinance, anyone availing themselves of city services. It won't be long before you hear the phrase, put down the library book and back away from the card catalog, right? We're talking about libraries and parks. Put down the picnic basket, step away from the potato salad. All right, some other examples, local immigration initiatives. There's one in Georgia and California that authorized local city officials to investigate and find landowners renting to undocumented workers. Now, see, this is a common trend that we see, is you know that you can't, theoretically, you know you can't do anything about people that are here illegally, so you're going to do something about those that rent to them, or those that do business with them, or those that employ them. So, and that's what you see in Georgia and California and in Texas, actually, in some places. Same thing in Chesapeake, Virginia, and in South Carolina. Counties enacted a local order that would suspend a business license for those hiring undocumented workers. There's some other, in Texas, we were talking a little bit about Texas cities. I should touch on one other kind of quasi-local initiative that's been, just because it's been the news recently, is that our Department of Public Safety was, by rule, limiting the ability of someone who is here legally, a legal immigrant, a foreign national who was here legally, to get a driver's license. And they were in the process, I think they adopted rules that would have made it harder for someone who is here as a legal immigrant to get a driver's license. And in April, a district court judge in Austin quashed that and said they issued an injunction against DPS from enforcing those rules. And I don't know what the status of that is. I know that that's pending right now, and I'm not sure where those rules are. Does anyone know? Okay. So that's the DPS attempting to limit the driver's licenses is another example of a local effort. You know, I think back to Seguin. I think about my hardworking code enforcement officers. And I can't imagine asking them to determine someone's immigration status. You know, we have, if we get a junked vehicle removed in Seguin, we have a party that Friday to celebrate the junked vehicle getting removed. I can't imagine trying to do immigration. Yes, ma'am. If you don't have your... Okay. Right. And that is the status right now?
Yes.
Okay, so DPS will not give you a driver's license unless you have what's known as the green card. You can prove that you're here legally. But if you're here legally, then they're not going to... It seemed like they were going to have like a different looking license like they did for minors. They're going to have a different looking license for legal immigrants. Right. Okay. Okay. Good. Okay, so DPS will not issue a driver's license unless you have a valid, updated green card showing that you're here legally. Great, thank you. Yes? It's not a snap for someone who is here legally to get a driver's license. Oh, and we're going to talk about in a little while what it means to be here legally. Okay. Great, thank you. We're going to talk a little bit about what it means to be here legally and how it may not be as easy a call as people might think. Okay. Now, here's one that I think is actually legitimate. This is what they call an ACCESS program, A-C-C-E-S-S, and it's also known as a 287G program. And it's part of the Immigration and Nationality Act that allows federal immigration authorities to train local law enforcement on the procedures used to check legal residency. So basically, it's a partnership between the federal immigration authorities and your local sheriff's office or police department, which would give them access to the federal database and train them on how to make those decisions as whether or not someone's here legally. So if your city is pursuing these immigration initiatives, this is a legitimate way to do it. And if you are charging your law enforcement with making these determinations, this would be a good way to go about doing it because they'd be getting proper training and not just guessing, which I think we see a lot. And then once they're trained, they have the authority to detain suspects themselves rather than wait ICE approval. So, but even this is not without controversy these days. We know how many of you've heard, I can't remember, Sheriff Joe in Arizona, is that where he's from? You know what I'm talking about? He's on the news a lot. Hmm? In El Paso too? What's going on in El Paso? Yes, local law enforcement. Yeah. Okay. Well, the sheriff in, where is he from? Maricopa County, Arizona. There we go, Sheriff Joe. He took advantage of this, and he had 60 of his jailers trained under one of these 287G programs, and then they went out and acted essentially as immigration officials. They determined people's status. They detained people. They took them back to the jail. They were processed by jailers who were trained under this program. So, of course, theoretically did it the right way. And then a couple months ago, Congress sent a letter to the new Secretary of Homeland Security accusing him of violating people's rights and asking them to look into not only the sheriff of Maricopa County, but also into this entire 287G program to determine whether or not, Congress ordered the Department of Homeland Security to look into this local training, whatever that means. So even if you avail yourself of this, there's no telling how long that's going to be good for. Georgia's done it. Florida's done it. I know a few cities in Texas have done it. I think Irving, I taught this class, and the judge from Irving said that in Irving, they bring somebody in if they suspect, when they're determining their nationality, they do a closed-circuit interview with ICE officials in Euless, and it's on TV, and so they make that determination, and those folks interact through closed-circuit TV with federal immigration officials in Euless. So they have a pretty sophisticated setup there, and it's done also pursuant to this provision in the law.
That U.S. Code?
U.S. Code is the Immigration and Nationality Act. I don't have the precise site. All right, so then we have, after we have all these local immigration initiatives, and then we have the courts responding to them. I call it not so fast. Hazleton, Pennsylvania, the one we heard the quote from the mayor, their local ordinance sought to fine landlords who rented to undocumented workers and to suspend business licenses of those who employed undocumented workers. And federal court said not so fast and ruled it preempted by federal statute. Said immigration is a federal matter, not a local matter, and they threw out the ordinance, the Hazleton ordinance. Farmers Branch, this one's still pending. Farmers Branch had a similar ordinance where they required landlords to verify the tenant's legal status, and that was invalidated by the federal judge. And then Farmers Branch did what I call the double not so fast. They had passed an ordinance that said, in the event that this one gets ruled unconstitutional and thrown out, then we're going to have a new one that automatically takes effect, and it shifts the burden from the landowner, the property owner, the employer, to the tenant or the worker. And so once the federal court said, no, we're throwing that out, it's preempted, then another local ordinance took effect that required the tenant to get a rental license from the city. So when you go in to get, you'd have to go in as a worker to the city hall to get your rental license, and then the city staff would have to verify your legal status. And guess what happened? They got sued on that, like, the next day. So that one's still pending. That has not been resolved. So you've got the first ordinance that had the burden on the property owners. That was thrown out. Now you've got the second ordinance that puts the burden on the workers or the tenants, and that's tied up in court, and we don't know what's going to happen with that one. But it's not being enforced. The last time I spoke, the judge from Farmers Branch was there, and he said, it's on hold, it's stayed, he's not hearing any cases, so I don't know what's going to happen. So we got to get you a little ethics credit, so we're going to talk a little judicial ethics. Concerns that you may have with these controversial ordinances. First of all, just remember, ethically, you don't write the ordinances, right? We as judges are not policymakers. We're supposed to be detached and neutral and fair and impartial. So you don't get involved with the writing of the ordinances, and you should insulate yourself from the political nature of these kind of discussions and these measures. Now, how many of you have had a city council or a mayor call you and say, hey, can we get your input on writing this ordinance? Yeah, it happens, right? This is my favorite. Can we get your input on writing this ordinance? And I said, well, as a judge, I'm supposed to be fair and impartial and not a policymaker, but third party. I'm going to sit in judgment of this ordinance, and I really shouldn't be involved in writing it. And the response was, yeah, but you work a lot cheaper than the city attorney does. Come on. So, sorry. You're going to have to spend a little money on your city attorney. So be careful. Canon 1 of the judicial conduct canon says that a judge shall uphold the integrity and independence. I stress independence of the judiciary. And so you need to be independent from the policymaking process, because ultimately you're going to sit in judgment of those, not of the policy itself, but of those people charged with violating it. All right, so just remember your role. Until a controversy is before you, until a case is before you, you really don't have the authority to weigh in on it. But what happens when it does come before you? What happens when that local immigration issue is filed in your court? What can you do, and what should you do, and what shouldn't you do? All right, so my advice is know your limits, okay? Those of you, lawyers are sneaky. I prosecuted them for 2 years. It would not surprise me if someone came to the municipal court and filed requested an injunction against enforcement of the ordinance. All right, look, municipal court, power to issue injunctions, injunctive relief, do we have it? No, we don't have it. Don't be fooled. Don't let somebody come talk you into signing an injunction or trying to grant a stay on the enforcement of an ordinance. Okay, it's not what we have. It's outside our limits. You cannot enjoin the enforcement of an ordinance. And remember Canon 3b2, which says a judge shall be faithful to the law. When you start acting outside your authority, that kind of triggers 3b2, and people wonder whether or not you're being faithful to the law when you're just doing stuff that you're not authorized to do. All right, so what do you do if you think that it's unconstitutional? Can you find it unconstitutional and say you're not going to enforce that anymore? What do you do? You find them not guilty, right? That's what you do. You don't find everybody not guilty. You don't enjoin the enforcement of it, but you find that case not guilty because it's unconstitutional. Okay? Does that stop the police from filing one the next day? No. What do you do with that one? Same thing. Not guilty. It's unconstitutional. They'll get the hint at some point. But that's how you handle an unconstitutional ordinance. Okay? All right. So even if you don't encounter these ordinances, you are more than likely going to encounter foreign nationals. Now, most of you here, magistrate, how many of you have dealt with a foreign national in your capacity as a municipal judge? Okay. All right, good. Well, lots of them. Okay, let's talk about the Vienna Convention. What is it? The Vienna Convention on Consular Relations was an international treaty that was established in 1963 and took effect in 1967. It's not new. Article 36 of the Vienna Convention requires that a foreign national be offered the opportunity to have his country's consulate notified that he is facing a criminal action. Okay? There are over 165 countries that are parties to the Vienna Convention. The United States is one of them. It has been since like 1969, I think. So this is nothing new, and just about everybody is a party to it. Here, the State Department offers this convenient chart for notification. Okay, did everybody get that? Good. Let's go back. This is helpful. There is a variation of this in the Attorney General's publication they have on this. But basically, let's just talk about the basics of it. Who has the obligation to notify someone, a foreign national, that they are being, to notify them of their rights under the Vienna Convention? A magistrate. And what the Vienna Convention says is the competent authority of the receiving state. So I don't want to get into debate over whether or not law enforcement officer is a competent authority. But certainly all of you that act as magistrates are competent authorities, and so you have an obligation under the Vienna Convention to notify a detained foreign national of the right to contact their consulate. Okay? So it falls to you. The magistrates are competent authorities of the receiving states. Now, when do you have to do it? It says to do it without delay, whatever that means. And the State Department guidelines, their guidelines say at the time that someone is booked into a jail. So it's your obligation as a magistrate, and you need to do it at the time they're booked into jail. Okay. Now, there will be, I guess, a couple of things worth noting on here, is that the detainee may communicate with the consular officer, so whoever's from their embassy, and may request consular access at any time. So they can change their mind. They may have been in jail for a day or a week, and they come back and say, I want to notify my embassy now. Okay. They're entitled to do that. And so they can assert that at any time. Another note, this says, I'm looking at this bottom left-hand corner that says, in all cases, consulate may have access to the detainee regardless of whether the detainee requests it. So if someone from the embassy shows up and wants to talk to them, that's fine. They can do that. The other thing to remember is that you are not supposed to inform the consulate that the person may be asserting that they're seeking political asylum. So if someone tells you, I'm here, they say, what country are you from? I'm from X country. Okay, well, we have to notify your consulate. Well, you know, I just lost a presidential election there, and they're threatening to cut my head off, and that's why I'm here. Don't tell the embassy that, okay? They don't want you to do that. If someone's seeking political asylum, that's not anything you relay to the embassy. But thankfully, the Attorney General's office has made it easy on notifying the embassy or the consulate, and we're going to talk about that in just a minute. All right, so let's talk about case law. because everybody loves case law as much as they love foreign national law. All right. This is what I call, how have the courts interpreted the Vienna Convention? And I call it, how cute a treaty. That's kind of what the courts have said, both the Court of Criminal Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court. Basically, we all know what the exclusionary rule is, right? If the state does something unlawful or violates the law in prosecuting a person or in securing evidence, then that evidence that was obtained illegally is excluded at that person's trial, right? So, is it illegal? What if you don't? What if the magistrate does not notify the detained person that they have a right to contact their consulate? What if you ignore your obligation under the Vienna Convention? And let's be clear. The Vienna Convention imposes an obligation on magistrates. You're obligated to find out where this person is from and notify them of their right to contact the consulate. So what happens if you don't do that? Have you violated the law? And what does it mean for the exclusionary rule? Well, not much, actually. The violation of the Vienna Convention will not exclude evidence as, I'm talking about the federal case, is Sanchez-Lamas versus Oregon, and the state case is Rocha v. State. And what they've said, both those cases stand for the proposition that, well, who cares? If you don't notify someone of their right to contact their consulate, we're not going to exclude the evidence because the treaty doesn't create a judicial remedy. So, yeah, you didn't do your duty, and yeah, you didn't notify them of their rights under international law, but that's okay. It doesn't create a judicial remedy. I go on to say that even though it creates an international obligation, it's a treaty, but it's not a law. It's not a binding domestic law unless Congress passes implementing legislation. And this kind of goes back to, there's two kinds of treaties. There's self-executing and there's non-self-executing. Those that are self-executing, Congress doesn't have to pass any law. They're just the treaty signed, boom, they're in place. Everybody abides by them, theoretically. A non-self-executing treaty says, well, it's nice. Everybody signed off on it, but it doesn't mean anything until Congress passes a law implementing the treaty. And what the courts have said is that the Vienna Convention is not self-executing. There needs to be some federal law implementing those procedures, and there has not been, so we don't care. You know, the bottom line is, well, we don't really expect all these municipal judges to know about the Vienna Convention, and if we want to, you know, get us a bad guy, we're going to do it, whether the municipal judge did their job right or not. So, how cute a treaty. That's kind of the deal. Which leads to the next question. If the big fancy courts don't care about the Vienna Convention, why should I care about the Vienna Convention? Well, first let's talk about the legal reasons for doing it. First of all, because no case and no court has actually relieved a magistrate of the obligation to provide the Vienna Convention notifications. Okay, they've all said, yeah, it's an obligation. Yes, the judge has to do it. But if the judge doesn't do it, we're not going to exclude the evidence. So you're not actually relieved of the duty to do it. The duty still exists. So that's one legal reason to do this. The second, remember the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, which says, all treaties which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. That's why it's called the Supremacy Clause. And it says that the treaties are the law of the land, and judges in every state, us, right, shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. So, I think the obligation still exists. And under that, you know, just because the courts have said, well, it doesn't grant a right to that person under U.S. law, it doesn't mean that you as a magistrate can ignore it. Okay, nothing has changed your obligation. All right, here's some practical reasons. If the big fancy courts don't care, why should I care? Well, hopefully you want to avoid legal challenges and litigation for you and for your city and for the state. You want to avoid legal challenges from the defendants, from their home countries, and from advocacy groups that advocate on behalf of people, of foreign nationals. We have been sued. The U.S. has been sued by Mexico, Germany, Paraguay, and other countries. They've sued the United States in the International Court of Justice for failure to abide by these conventions. Now, I suggest that that's not the best way to get an all-expenses trip to paid trip to Europe is to be sued in the International Court of Justice. Maybe you think differently. I don't know. So we want to avoid challenges from these different entities and different individuals. You also want to avoid investigations and complaints by the media and by the Commission on Judicial Conduct. And I'll just speak to each of those real briefly. First of all, the Commission on Judicial Conduct in the last year has initiated charges against a presiding judge of the Court of Criminal Appeals and a Texas Supreme Court justice. And I would suggest that if they're willing to do that, they're probably willing to initiate charges against the municipal judge of Wood Creek. Okay, they're pretty serious about what they do, and they don't like judges who ignore the law. So let's keep everyone out of trouble with the commission. Secondly is the media. How often do we see good stories about municipal court in the media? Right? Usually municipal courts, we fly under the radar, right? We don't make the front page of the paper. If we do, it's because usually one of two reasons. One is something's gone horribly wrong, right? We've violated somebody's rights or there's some financial scandal or something like that. The second is maybe we've got the president's kids as defendants in our court. Other than that, you know, or some Hollywood starlets slap somebody and we got her in our court. I don't know. It's usually a famous defendant or some awful fiasco that lands us in the paper. Or some woman has 18 dogs in her house. That's right. In Seguin, we only allow 15 dogs in your house. All right, so if big fancy courts don't care, why should I? Finally, because it's something that I call the golden rule. I didn't make this up. I tried to take credit for it at one school, and somebody got very offended. We all know what the golden rule is. There are approximately, by some estimates, about 3,000 Americans a year who get arrested or detained in foreign countries, which I think is kind of a lot. Who are they? Well, you've got tourists that go overseas or go to foreign countries and get arrested or detained. You've got service members. You've got Peace Corps volunteers or missionaries or someone doing good deeds in a foreign country. You've got exchange students. You got spring breakers prone to stupid behavior. I was going to tell a story about when I was a spring breaker and some of my behavior, but then I guess there's this note here that says, you're being audio taped. So I'm not going to tell that story after all. Finally, anyone relying on the protection of the U.S. consulate. You know, the consulate does stuff besides when you're detained. Your embassy serves a lot of functions, not just when you get in trouble with the law, but, I mean, it helps find missing Americans. It helps if you're, you know, if the volcano erupts or there's a coup or a riot or something like that. I mean, the embassy is where you go. And so we want our embassies across the world to be able to help our folks. And so we need to return the favor, and need to, you know, I guess what I'm saying is the golden rule starts at the local level, right? When we have foreign nationals in our court, we better treat them right and follow the law, because if it's our kid or our grandkid or us that's doing something in another country and we find ourselves detained, we're going to want that same protection and we're going to want the same opportunity to notify our consulate. I think of something, to paraphrase my dad, who's crazy, you know, his attitude is, if anybody's going to hit my kid with a bamboo cane, it's going to be me, and it's going to be in America. That's his idea of the golden rule. All right. Let's talk about the actual practical administration of the Vienna Convention. What clues might lead you to suspect that you're dealing with someone who is a foreign national? Right? I mean, pretty common sense, inability to speak English, no valid identification. What you need to do is you need to ask them, are you a U.S. citizen? Not, are you here legally? We're going to talk about that in a minute. But are you a U.S. citizen? It's real easy. It's yes or no. If they answer no, then you ask where they're from. You make a finding of where they're from for the record, and then you begin the Vienna Convention notification process. All right, what do you have to do? You have to determine the citizenship on the record. They're not a U.S. citizen, you ask them what country they're a citizen of. You make a note of that. Make a note of that in the file. Make a finding on the record. I mean, that's just what, write it in the file. Then you have to determine whether they're from a mandatory notification country or an optional notification country. Now, there's I put a link in the paper to the, and I didn't print it out because it's like this thick, but the Attorney General's office has a paper that has a list of mandatory notification countries and optional notification countries. So the mandatory ones, if they say, I'm from this country, I can't remember what, Zimbabwe, you got to notify them. You turn to the Z's in your book, find the closest Zimbabwe consulate, you fill it out, and you fax it in there. You have to notify them. If they're from an optional country, then you let the detainee decide, okay? So what country do we deal mostly with? Mexico. All right, Mexico is an optional notification country. That means if you have someone who is a Mexican citizen who's in front of you, it is their choice whether or not you notify their consulate, because you don't have to, it's optional. Now, I taught this one time, and at the end the judge said, so it's up to me whether I notify. Whoa, no, wake up, pay attention. It's not your option, it's the detainee's option. They get to decide whether or not their consulate is notified. So, let's say it's someone from Mexico. You inform them of their right to contact their consulate, and they make that decision. And if they say, no, we don't need to do that, okay, then you have a form. There's a form in the Attorney General's handbook that has that, and you have them sign that, and they decline in writing. You've got a paper for the file where you've offered them that option, and they have declined it, put it in there. If they say, yeah, I'd like to notify my consulate, guess what? Turn to the M's in the book. It's got a form there. You fax it to the consulate. Okay, I have so-and-so, and he's detained in X jail. He's facing criminal charges. He has asked that the consulate be notified. Put on the fax machine, zap it out there, get a confirmation, put it in the file. You've done your duty. Yes, ma'am. Do I mean you, the judge, or may the judge delegate it to police communications? I say you may delegate it, but you should make sure it gets done, right? I mean, I guess there really is a fact question. Do you trust the jailer to do it? That's really the issue. You can delegate that, sure, and ask them, get a fax confirmation and put it in the file. It's not something you have to do yourself, but you have to see that it gets done. How's that? Okay. I think the form does have a place for what charges that they're facing. Yeah, I think so. But all that stuff is in the Attorney General's handbook. It's very helpful, and it's got, I mean, if you just fill in the blanks and type in the fax number or have somebody type in the fax number, you're going to be okay. And just, you know, that's my advice, is pad the file just to cover yourself. And if you can show that you offered, you notified them of their rights, and if they refused it, you got proof of that. If they said, no, I want to talk to my consulate, all right, you got proof that you notified the consulate, then hopefully that'll keep you out of trouble, which is my main goal. And you do that without delay. That's what the law says. All right, permitting a phone call is not enough. If they say, yes, I'd like to contact my consulate, go, here you go. No, not enough. And that's, but you have to use those forms, and you have to notify the consulate in writing and get proof. You know, allowing them to make a phone call is not going to cover you enough. And like I said, don't mention if they're seeking political asylum. All right, practical matters. We talked about this. What does without delay mean? Well, it means at the time of booking. And so really, before you leave, before you wrap up your magistrate duties, I would encourage you to make sure that those things are done. If they want notification, make sure that it got done and got faxed to the proper authority. Pad the file. This is what's going to help keep you out of trouble. Get a copy of whatever document you use to determine their citizenship, the offer in English and in the native language, and they have those in that book, the written acceptance or refusal, and then, like we said, if they accept it and they request notification, get a copy of the fax that was sent to the consulate with the confirmation of delivery, and hopefully this will pad the file enough and keep you out of trouble. All right, ethical considerations. This, and I guess in putting this together, I thought this was the most interesting, and maybe if you don't take anything else away from this, take this away from it. The Vienna Convention stuff is for foreign nationals. It has absolutely nothing to do with illegal immigration. It has nothing to do with whether someone's here legally or illegally. It has only to do with whether or not they are a U.S. citizen. So if they're a student and they're not a U.S. citizen, they're here legally, you got to give it to them. If they're a documented worker, you got to give it to them. If they're, I mean, anything, if they're a foreign exchange student and they're detained, it doesn't matter. So when you're talking about Vienna Convention, do not get hung up on whether they're here legally or illegally. Status is completely irrelevant. It's just whether or not they're a U.S. citizen. So Canon 3B5 says that a judge shall perform his duties without bias or prejudice. Status is irrelevant. Foreign national includes those who are here legally or illegally. We don't care, okay? If they are not a naturalized citizen of the United States, they get the Vienna Convention warnings. Those with a green card or permanent legal alien status are still foreign nationals. They're not U.S. citizens. And as foreign nationals, they must be given the opportunity to notify their consular authority. If they've had a green card and they've been here for 10 years, or this person that you try to help has been here for 10 years, speaks perfect English, was born in another country, but they've still not become naturalized U.S. citizens, they're foreign national. And so they're entitled to the, you know, they may have not been to their home country since they were a baby, but that doesn't matter. Foreign national, they get the option of notification. So don't get hung up on status. And think about, you know, think about those examples we talked about, Americans that travel overseas, you know. We want them to have the protections and the ability to contact their embassy, whether or not they're there legally, right, or not. You know, the tourists, their students, we want them to have those protections. All right, so for the forms, the Magistrate's Guide on the Vienna Convention by the Texas Attorney General's Office, go to that link. It has a full list of countries, translated forms, and very detailed, specific instructions. So keep one at the jail, print it out, so it's long, but print it out, you know, put a big paper clip on it, keep it next to the fax machine at the jail. It's ready to go. All right. Let's see what else we've got. All right, let's talk about ICE, right? Everybody's heard ICE. Everyone has heard the term ICE hold, right? We've heard that. ICE is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It's part of the Department of Homeland Security. It was formerly INS and Customs, and they got combined after 9/11 to create ICE. So where is ICE? ICE is just about everywhere. They have a presence in the Travis County Jail. Any of your local jails have an ICE officer, ICE presence in your jail? Where are you from? Montgomery County. You have an ICE official? An agent drives up from Houston every day? Well, that's good. So he just checks everybody that comes in the jail for immigration. Okay. Everyone with a Hispanic surname, he checks for immigration status. Yeah, okay. Anyone else have ICE presence in your local jail? El Paso? Anybody else? Where are you from? Hidalgo County. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Started about 3 years ago. Just B's age of felony.
Now everything. Okay, this judge has said that where he's from, that ICE has asked the detention officers, if you determine someone's not a U.S. citizen, please notify us. So the jailers notify, they call ICE, and then ICE makes, we'll come down and...
ICE calls them.
The detainee. Okay, so ICE interviews the detainee on the phone, and they determine the status. And you said it used to be for A's, B's, and felonies, but now it's for everything. Okay. All right, well, I think we're going to see more and more of that ICE presence interacting with local jails, city and county jails. All right. What is an ICE hold? You know, it's a detainer. It's a request from ICE to the local jurisdiction to detain a foreign national for transfer to an ICE facility or investigation by ICE. Okay, what it indicates is that federal immigration authorities have questions about the status of a person, and it requests a local authority to notify ICE before the named person is released. Okay, and it's a request and not an order, but I mean, as a practical matter, if someone has an ICE hold, they're released from your jail, right, and they're sent off to ICE. Either ICE comes and gets them, or your locals transfer them. Is that how it works? Essentially? Yeah. Okay. All right. What does an ICE hole mean? And this is kind of, to me, the most important part of this. From a judicial ethics standpoint, you know, it could mean a lot of things. And I guess my biggest piece of advice, what to take away from this part is don't jump to conclusions. An ICE hole could mean a lot of things. It could mean that person is illegally present. And we're going to talk about what illegally present means in a moment. And this may be where I need some expert help. It could mean that they're wanted for a federal investigation. It does not necessarily mean that they're facing criminal prosecution. Okay? So don't jump to, because there's an ICE hole doesn't mean that they're going to go to jail. Federal pen doesn't mean they're going to be deported. So don't necessarily assume that they're facing criminal charges. An ICE hold requests notification of a prisoner's release and disposition of criminal charges. Okay, and like we said, in a practical sense, what that means is they wrap up their case with you, and then you either send them off to ICE or ICE, somebody, you know, you hold them for 48 hours till ICE comes and gets them. All right, so this to me is maybe the most relevant thing for the ICE portion of this presentation is talking about illegal versus criminal. And I think that from my perspective, what's interesting is that someone can be here illegally under immigration law but not be here criminally or not be facing any criminal charges. So that's important, a very important distinction. And every time I teach this, I learn a little more, so hopefully I'll learn something more today, and I have to kind of refine this because it's really complicated. So this is general terms, and I think there's like every rule, there's exceptions to it. But for the offense of improper entry, that's a federal crime for entering the U.S. at an improper time or place or using fraudulent means to enter. And it is not an ongoing offense. You commit it, and once you're over here, let's say you swim across the river. You swim across the river, you have committed a criminal act, you have crossed at an improper place. You do that on July 1st. That is the offense. That's the offense date. Once you're over here, it's done, right? The crime is done. It's not an ongoing thing. And that is a criminal matter. Now, I asked my friend from El Paso, does that sound right? Okay, good. Illegal presence is not a criminal matter, but a civil matter, and it's an ongoing status offense. It subjects the offender not to criminal prosecution, but to deportation rather than prosecution. It's an ongoing offense. You swim across the river. You've committed a crime of improper entry. You remain here. You're not committing a new criminal act every day you're here, but you are here in violation of a civil law. You are here, you are illegally present, which will subject you not to prosecution, but to deportation. So, is that right? So what happens if you, well, let's see where we're going with this. You know, I think, and then I taught this one time and I had an immigration expert and they said, well, really it depends on your mental state when you cross the border, and it got really complicated. I thought, oh man. And then between the last time I taught this and today, we have a new Secretary of Homeland Security, and she said that, well, immigration isn't a criminal matter, it's a civil matter. Well, and you can imagine the talk radio blowback was severe, saying, oh, she doesn't even know it's criminal. But I think it shows just how complicated these issues are, and you can't make a general statement like that. You even have the Homeland Security chief saying, well, it's not really criminal, it's really civil. Well, kind of, sometimes, but it's complicated, which is why I caution you not to jump to conclusions about whether someone's here illegally. And maybe they're here illegally, but maybe they're not committing a crime, right? So, as an example, let's say someone comes here legally. They get a green card, okay? They come here, their green card expires, they stay here. Have they committed an offense of improper entry?
No.
Are they illegally present for civil purposes?
Yes.
Do they face deportation?
Yes.
Do they face criminal prosecution?
No.
Okay, are they here illegally? Right? They've overstayed. They're here in violation of the law. Are they here In violation of a criminal law? No. Immigration law, right? But not, they're not facing jail time, they're facing deportation. So it's those kind of distinctions that I caution you against jumping to conclusions, because it's not easy to figure out, and it's easy to get wrong. And so that's why I would encourage you not to presume anything. Do you have a duty to report? All right, does a municipal judge have a duty to report someone here illegally? Well, first of all, like we talked about, what does it mean to be here illegally? Maybe they've entered unlawfully, in which case they may be, have committed a crime and may be facing criminal prosecution. Maybe they overstayed their visa. Maybe they violated their terms of entry. They got here legally and then they didn't do what they were supposed to do, and so that's also a civil infraction. So what does it mean? It's real easy to say, well, I got an illegal here in front of me. Well, what does that mean? Do you know what that means? And without knowing, first of all, that person's individual circumstances, and secondly, a lot of immigration law, you're probably not in a good position to make that call whether they're here illegally or not. And I think sometimes there is there's this thought that, well, they're here illegally and I'm a judge and so I need to tell somebody. Well, we don't know if they're here. That doesn't mean that they're here criminally, and it doesn't mean that they violated a law, that they're facing prosecution. So before you pick up the phone and turn them in, it might be good to know whether they're really here illegally or whether they're here criminally. So I would encourage you against, you don't have a duty to report. Okay, so I guess the answer to that question is, do you have a duty to report to ICE that you think someone is here illegally? No, you don't have a duty to report to ICE that someone is here illegally. I've read papers, academic papers about this that would suggest even the opposite, that if you are reporting someone to ICE that you think is here illegally, you may be violating that Canon 3B we talked about, which says that you should perform your duties without bias or prejudice. When you jump to conclusions about someone's status and then decide, well, I'm going to turn them in because they're an illegal, well, be careful, because you may end up, you think you're doing the right thing, you may end up getting yourself in trouble. So be very careful about that. And think about what it means to be a judge. What's your job as a judge? Well, your job is to review the evidence before you and to render an impartial decision. And so do that when you're dealing with foreign nationals or with people that are detained. You know, look at the evidence before you. You don't have enough evidence, more than likely, to determine what their status is and whether they're here illegally or criminally. And your job is to consider the evidence and render an impartial decision. So just, y'all do that in court. Do it when you're making these determinations at the jail. All right. What do we learn, if anything? Hopefully we learn something. Learn a little bit about municipal efforts to regulate immigration at the local level and how that impacts you, and what your ethical obligations are if you get those cases that come before you, those pseudo-immigration ordinances, and what your limitations are as a judge on how you handle those. Hopefully we've learned that you do have a distinct responsibility and obligations under the Vienna Convention. Go to the Attorney General's website and print out that form. Fill up the printer with paper and print it out and keep it right there by your stuff and by the fax machine. And even though, think about the golden rule starts at the local level. Even though the big fancy courts may not give much weight to these violations, you still have the obligation to impart those warnings. And so I'd encourage you to do so. Talked a little bit about ICE holds and what that means for y'all. And hopefully we learned enough immigration law and judicial ethics to keep you out of trouble, out of the newspaper, away from the Commission on Judicial Conduct. That is my only goal. If I don't want to see any of you written up in the paper or see your sanction on the website of the Commission on Judicial Conduct. So that's really my goal, is to help fellow judges stay on the right side of the law. I always encourage people. I've been teaching for the center for a long time, and I always tell people, call me with questions, email me with questions. I feel like that would be a disservice to y'all. So I say, if you have questions about immigration law, don't ask me. If you want to talk about anything else, call me, send me an email. I don't care. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk to you, and hopefully we'll all stay out of trouble. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Ross. Okay, our next session is at 10:45. Everybody in here. Thank you.